So this is about just adding a constraint onto our process to just force us to figure out how to do something differently in order to get the result that we want, which is very high quality hires. You know, every hire, our rule is that they raise the bar for our team. And that's still true today, even though we've been hiring 35% women for the last few months.
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Ainsley Robertson. She is Manager of Developer Experience at Clio. Welcome, Ainsley.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited to chat today. And what I want to hear about first, so that we can understand what it is that you do, let's learn about that. You know, what is your role at Clio? What is your mission as Manager of Developer Experience?
Well, I think one of the easiest ways to explain this is to think of it as sort of two buckets of work, internal and external. And the internal piece is culture related and experience related. And the external piece is about putting our dev organization on the map in Canada and across North America. And so internally, that takes the shape of anything that makes Clio an even better place to work, but specifically for developers. And externally, that takes the shape of getting our team out in the community and talking about the work that they're doing, getting our team writing more about the work that they're doing, a strategy around what are the right kind of things for us to be involved in order for us to have an increased presence in the communities that we operate in. And overall, this contributes to hopefully building and retaining a really great team within development at Clio. And we have at Clio, we're a 300-person company. So we have a people operations department, and we have a marketing department. And within people operations, we have employee experience, talent acquisition, talent acceleration. So there are really dotted lines between me and all of those teams. Nothing I do is anything that I do all on my own. Mm-hmm. It's always cross-functional and really collaborative with other folks who care about these things within our org.
Okay. And tell us just a little bit about what Clio does.
Sure. Clio builds software for lawyers. So we build legal practice management software. That's everything from CRM to document management, timekeeping, invoicing. We process payments. We have a mobile app and a client portal. So, and we recently acquired a company based in Los Angeles called Lexicata, and they have a CRM that we're integrating into Clio as well, which is really exciting. So anything that you can think of that helps lawyers manage their firm and manage their business better.
That's really cool, because I can imagine, I mean, I've never been a lawyer. I don't know what it's like to be a lawyer, but I can imagine that there's some really specific needs, like within customer relationship management or payment processing or document management.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, lawyers really run businesses, and a lot of them never, you know, went to school to learn how to run a business. And so we like to try to make life a little bit easier for our customers who are trying to run businesses, who are trying to spend less time on things that aren't billable work, whether that's managing their business or trying to get more business. And so there's a lot of different areas there that Clio can contribute to. And then on top of that, we were the first cloud-based legal practice management solution. So that allows our customers to take us wherever they go, which also helps them, you know, get the live the lifestyles that they want to. I talked to someone, I was a product manager at Clio for almost 2 years. And one of my favorite stories was talking to a customer at our annual customer conference who runs her entire practice from her phone and her iPad. And she said before Clio, she never was able to take vacation. You know, she's a solo or a small firm, And now with Cleo, she can run her firm no matter where she is. She can, you know, take a couple of weeks and go visit her kids across the country and be able to keep on top of her work, no matter if she's in an airport or, you know, at someone else's house or on the go at a cafe. So that's something that's really important to us as well.
That is a really cool story. And I can imagine that it's a really cool vision and a really cool purpose to get behind, that everybody who works at Cleo could essentially say, hey, I help lawyers have life outside of work. Like, that's cool. That's a really cool vision.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think the real, like, driving, one of the big driving forces for a lot of us at Cleo is also the opportunity to, if we make managing a firm easier or more efficient for lawyers, that ultimately this can help to lower the cost of obtaining legal services and increase access to justice for more people, maybe more people who are working class. For example, like, I probably shouldn't admit this, but I've never had a lawyer look over an employment contract because that stuff's expensive. Mm-hmm. And hopefully in the long run, we'll be able to help make legal services more affordable so that more people have access and are protected in those situations.
I love that too. That's also a great mission, a great purpose to get behind. One other thing that I wanted to talk about, Ainsley, was essentially kind of understanding where you fit within Cleo. And you started to talk about that, but I want to understand it a little bit more, because when I read a little bit about, you know, what you do on LinkedIn, it seems to me like an in-between kind of a role that may not exist at every company, but I really, in reading about it and even just hearing you just describe it, I wish it existed more. Just that we can, like, paint a picture. You're within People Ops, is that correct?
I'm not, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm organizationally and physically located within engineering.
Okay. So that automatically makes it go like, oh, that's even more interesting now, because the way that you describe it, it actually does sound very much like a people ops, you know, human resources kind of thing. But the fact that it's like, no, I'm in engineering, that just makes it even more intriguing. So how would you, it's just a really interesting role that I haven't seen a lot of. So I guess the question is, help us understand, especially given that it overlaps with a lot of stuff, a lot of org, features I'm on the software mind. It overlaps with a lot of other organizational positions and roles. Why is a role like yours needed?
Yeah, so it might be helpful just to kind of go back to the beginning. I've been at Cleo for just over 2 years, and the majority of that I spent as a product manager, as I mentioned. And earlier this year, about 6 months ago, our VP of engineering was ready to start scaling our engineering org pretty rapidly. He'd been around for about 6 months. He was our first VP of engineering and had kind of got his house in order. And Cleo is really at a point in its life where we know what we need to do, and our biggest constraint has just been people. And so we were ready to turn up the heat and scale our organization. And he realized that there were some really important aspects of scaling, especially scaling that quickly, that he was going to need some help with. And he saw that I'd been doing a lot of this stuff off the side of my desk while I was a product manager, because I care a lot about it. I care a lot about making Cleo a really great place to work. And I care a lot about the experience that that our team has, and the kind of culture that we're building, and our values, and was pulled into almost any conversation related to that at Cleo. I was getting really involved in anything related to diversity and inclusion at Cleo. I was always out in the community, meeting people at events. I started a really well-received meetup for women in product in Vancouver. So he saw all of this happening and realized that he was going to need help around, you know, how we get our name of the development organization out in the community, and how we continue to build a really great culture internally and he said, hey, why don't you come and do those things for me full time in engineering? And like I mentioned earlier, you know, we do have a people team who does really great work. We have an incredible people organization, both on the talent acquisition side, as well as the talent acceleration side, which is what we call our HR business partners. But I think that at that point in time, he was seeing that we just needed a little bit of focus, of someone who lived within the org who was going to make sure that those things happened and champion them. Mm-hmm. And those folks in people are really important partners in everything that I do. And we work really closely together. But I sit next to our VP and make sure that his vision is carried out, work with him to build a strategy that's like really specific to our department. And I think part of the special sauce was that I'd been in the org for almost 2 years and also had a lot of relationships and a lot of understanding of, you know, the history of the organization, kind of where we've been, as well as where we're going. And I think all of those things kind of combined helped me get things done.
That's awesome. Would it be fair to say that this was a role that was created specifically for you because the VP of engineering saw that this is what you were doing and saw a need for that within engineering?
There's a little bit of that for sure. And I think the other, this role was created because there was a specific need in these areas. And, you know, I went through a process to determine whether or not I was the right candidate.
Sure.
But I think it was a bit serendipitous that, you know, that my VP had these specific needs and saw someone within arm's reach who could help to meet them really quickly. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, of course, I mean, there's the opportunity to capitalize on someone's strengths and create a role that's really going to play to them. So it was really cool to have that opportunity as well.
Yeah. And that's the reason that I asked about that. It's a very cool example of needs versus strengths versus this is what you're good at. And this is what you wanted to do. It's what you find yourself doing on just even on your off time. And there was a need for it. And it is so cool because it's inspiring in a way as well, because I know that there's people out there who are like, well, I'm in this role. It's not the exact perfect fit role for me. And actually the exact perfect fit role for me doesn't quite exist yet. And they're like, I hear these stories, I hear through the grapevine of, you know, the roles being created for people when it's like this need meets strength kind of a situation. So I love having those really tangible examples of that actually happening to inspire folks to take a look and say, hey, you know what? This might be the kind of a role, whether it's your role or a different kind of a role. Very, very cool story.
Yeah. I think that great organizations pay attention to the strengths of the people on their team. And if there's an opportunity to tap into those more deeply than you have in the past, I think great organizations acknowledge that and find ways to do it. I mean, it's better for Clio and it's better for me to tap into my strengths as much as possible. And I think that's where sometimes, you know, new roles can be developed or roles can evolve to just better take advantage of what your people are really, really great at rather than, you know, adhering to these really strict, like, well, that role doesn't exist. So,
yeah. And I'm curious so you said you were a product manager before this at Clio. Was most of your career before that in product management or product management kind of roles or other kinds of roles?
I've been in product management for about 4 years before making the change. And my career prior to that has taken kind of a winding role. Four years in product management was actually probably the longest that I spent doing anything. Mm-hmm. I have a bachelor of business degree. And during university, I started a nonprofit organization in Saskatchewan in Canada, and had a really, really great time doing that. Basically just getting to be an entrepreneur and getting to apply a lot of the things that I was learning in school and make a ton of mistakes. And it really became my greatest teacher in terms of just figuring things out and also building community, which relates to what I'm doing today. Mm-hmm. And so after university, I worked for another nonprofit so I could continue to volunteer at mine on the side. And then after that, I worked for a venture capital fund manager in marketing and communications, and I did some sales. And then I found myself in a new city and kind of stumbled into the tech world. Mm-hmm. And the role that I stepped into was supposed to be more like marketing and business development, but it was a startup with six devs, the CEO and me. Mm-hmm. And so you do whatever needs to get done in that scenario. And so I ended up taking over support and getting to know our product and our industry and our customers really, really well. And that's kind of how I stumbled into product management.
Okay. And then what then led to that interest in I was going to say the people side of things, not that product isn't about people. I know it absolutely is. But, you know, more in terms of like employee development, you know, making sure that you're doing initiatives like diversity and inclusion and things like that. What was there a particular moment in time or something in particular that made you want to kind of explore that world a little bit more and separate from the world of product management?
Mm-hmm. I mean, my whole time at Clio, I've been really involved in anything related to diversity and inclusion. But I think earlier this year, I was spending some time trying to figure out what was going to come next for me in product management and what my future looked like, how I wanted to grow and develop personally and professionally. And I was starting to realize that maybe some of my values weren't really being met as a product manager, if that makes sense. Like the values of community building, of being of service to others. And there are a lot of things that I loved about being a product manager, especially the customer empathy side of things. Mm-hmm. But I was having a hard time reconciling, you know, some of these things that I was really passionate about and the fact that my day-to-day job didn't really tap into that. And I enjoyed being a product manager, so I didn't really know what to do with this sort of newfound revelation. Okay. And maybe serendipitously, it was around that time that my now VP approached me and said, you know, I'd like to talk to you about this. So I was sort of I wasn't seriously thinking about leaving product management at that point in time, but I did have this thought in the back of my mind that I wasn't really sure what to do with yet. So I was open to the conversation and to trying to imagine what this road would look like. I mean, it's a little bit of a scary one too, because, you know, we didn't just create the role. So there's not really this, you know, really clear career path that comes out of it or mm-hmm. what the next step is. And we have to build that together as we go. So I have days where that's a little unnerving, but right now I'm just focused on the fact that on a day-to-day basis, I really care about the work that I'm doing and I'm making an impact. And I've got a great VP who wants to have those conversations about what's going to come next and is going to figure it out with me. So I think with time, we'll figure out what comes next.
yeah. And I really appreciate that you shared about that sort of the scary piece of it, because it is, wow, this is something new. And when you build something new, there's a lot of unknowns. And it actually reminded me of something that one of my coaches told me once, that basically the difference between fear and excitement is just a 2 millimeter shift that, you know, like how exciting, right? Like how exciting is it that you get to shape, that you get to shape the role, right? And that maybe there's going to be other people who will be like that you might manage that might be in your role now, and that you'll, you maybe if you decide to go in that direction, or, you know, who knows what it can be. So, you know, absolutely. Oh, it's sort of like unknown, but it's also just very cool. Even just hearing the story, like I'm feeling the excitement for you. Like it's very cool to hear that. Hi everyone, we'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview. And the other thing that I wanted to start talking about, Ainsley, is you mentioned the day-to-day, and I'd like to get a sense of what that day-to-day looks like for you, especially given this is a role that not a lot of people are familiar with or even knew that it was needed. So let's get into the weeds a little bit to talk about, you know, how you serve the developers at Clio. So what are some of examples of some of the initiatives that you've led?
Sure. Well, I think the most exciting one that I'm really stoked on right now and really passionate about is that we implemented a gender quota in our hiring this year, which I know evokes a lot of controversial opinions, and a lot of it can evoke some anxiety or concerns. And we knew that going into it and thought it was worth a shot. As I mentioned, we're scaling our engineering organization right now. And at the beginning of this big hiring push, 13% of technical roles in engineering were held by women. And we thought that wasn't good enough. And we thought that it was very unlikely that we'd make significant change without mandating that change must happen. Mm-hmm. And we thought that it was also very possible that in scaling very quickly, we could inadvertently have a negative impact on that percentage, which is also not okay. Mm-hmm. So we set the goal to get to 25% by the end of the year. And today we're at 21.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. So I was going to ask what the goal was. So you're at 21%. So 21% women in engineering.
Yeah, in what we call our software development and production engineering, our systems engineering roles. Mm-hmm. So basically in technical roles. That doesn't include product managers or product design, which we also kind of are within our what we call our product org. So just within those technical roles. So hopefully, you know, 4% more to go by the end of the year. Who knows, maybe we can even pull it out of the water. And our plan is to keep moving that number upwards. Our VP dreams of a day where we have 40% of those roles held by women, because that's really the critical number at which a lot of the perceived challenges of being a woman in a male-dominated industry kind of just go away, because there's just so many of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so remind me what percentage you went, you're at 21 now. Where were you when you started?
We started at 13 on June 1st.
Okay. So within a matter of months, you were able to go, and this is So for context, this was part of a big hiring initiative, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So our initiative was to almost double the product team by the end of the year.
Okay.
So that's where I think a lot of the risk lies as well. When hiring that quickly, quite frankly, the guys' resumes will always appear. They'll always be there. It's easy to find talented guys, and finding talented women is another story. And our hiring process hasn't changed. The way we evaluate candidates hasn't changed, aside from, of course, always trying to get better at how we manage our own unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. But what has changed is just that we've more intentionally sourced women candidates. And we were hiring somewhere in the range of like 10-13% women before we started. And I expected that, so in order to hit 25% by the end of the year, 35% of our hires would need to be women.
Mm-hmm.
And I expected that it would take us a while to ramp up to that, okay, considering where we were starting. And then, we by the end of the year, we'd need to be hiring even more women in order to meet our target. But it kind of blew me away. And I think this is the magic of a mandate, is not to say that it was easy, but right out of the gate, we just started hiring 35% women. Like, we just said, we're going to do this. And then it just happened.
Okay.
Of course, with a lot of really hard work as we dug into, the new areas of our community that maybe we weren't sourcing candidates previously, in order to find some just amazing, amazing women to join our team. And so it makes me really excited to know that that it's possible for us to even, turn up even higher next year, that a stretch goal is possible if we were able to just hit 35% right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're able to go just within a matter of months, within 5 months or so, from 13% of the engineering organization being women to 21%. And a mm-hmm. huge part of that was intentionally sourcing more women candidates. Talk to us a little bit about what sourcing means. So this is part of the hiring process, but a lot of people, it's like, oh, sourcing, what's that? Oh, it's HR speak. But, so sourcing, would you call that step number one in the hiring process, or is there something that comes before that?
That's a great question. I mean, maybe before that is just sort of brand building activities. It's always easier when you reach out to someone if they've heard of you before. So what are the different ways that we get our name out in the community and also try to showcase what it's like to work at Clio?
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's writing on our blog or getting our team speaking at events, different ways that can show, what's the culture like, what kind of people work there, what kind of problems do they solve, how do they work, what is Clio value, what are the people who work at Clio value. And then the next step is connecting with potential candidates, whether that's searching for folks on LinkedIn or we going to events. I go to a ton of events, and I know our whole talent acquisition team does as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to meet as many people as we can, tell them about Clio, learn a little bit about what they're looking for. Then I'll, set up a coffee with someone. Like, I think it's nice to, I'm not a recruiter, so I'm not, jumping into a phone screen right away.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's nice to give folks the opportunity to ask questions about Clio, interview me a little bit about what it's like to work there and what opportunities they might have. It gives me an opportunity if we grab coffee to learn about what they're looking for in their next role, what's going to be important to them. Are they looking for an opportunity to move into management? Are they looking for more mentorship? Are they looking for autonomy? Are they looking for growth? Are they looking to learn from other people? What's missing in their current role that we may be able to fulfill at Clio? And so, because sometimes it's not the right fit, and then it's not even, worth throwing them into a phone screen and into the hiring process with our talent acquisition team.
Mm-hmm.
So I also spend a lot of time doing that, just connecting with people in the community. And you know, the great thing that happens sometimes is I had coffee with someone a few weeks ago who ultimately decided to take a different position. But she was so impressed by the conversations that she had with folks at Clio that she sent me a referral for a friend of hers last week. And so I consider that all of those connecting and coffees and whatever, those things are really brand building as well. And just the more people we can touch in the community and give them a sense of what Clio is all about, the better chance we'll have at attracting great talent to work at Clio.
Yeah, and that's it's so important. Thank you for going for all through all of the details there, you know, in terms of the marketing, the searching for candidates, the networking, the recruitment. That's a piece of it that people often miss. It's like, oh, well, we want more women, we just need to hire more women. But yeah, but like, how are you going to get them in the door? How are you going to get them excited about working there? How are you going to get them to say yes when you offer them the job? So there's so many steps that come before, okay, we just need to make sure we bring in more women to interview. So that's just a really important point there. And so for you, when you say more intentionally sourcing women, do you mean that basically during those that pre-process where it's like pre-bring them in for an interview or whatever it might be, that you're intentionally marketing and you're intentionally recruiting and you're intentionally reaching out to women and possibly even more women than men?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I've been looking at, you know, what are the right events for us to be a part of in the community and, you know, not even just the right audience, but the right opportunities for us to showcase the Clio culture, as well as spending, a lot of time just connecting in whatever way we can with different women in the community and spending a lot of time on that. Because as I said, you know, like the quite frankly, the resumes will of really talented men will always land in our inbox. And I mean, I could go into, you know, all of the theory behind why this happens. You know, I think it's really well known now, the stat of the fact that men will apply for a job when they're barely qualified and women won't apply unless they're overqualified. Like there's all these reasons that contribute to the fact that we don't see the same numbers of applications just organically landing in our inbox from women as we do from men. Even if you look at the, you know, compared to graduation rates. And so we have to work a little bit harder to go and tap those women on the shoulder at an event and say, like, tell me about the work that you're doing. And then I think that sounds really interesting. Can I tell you about Clio?
And to get a little bit more in the weeds here, you had mentioned the 10% to 35%. So going from, let me make sure I have this right, going from hiring 10% of women to hiring 35% of women. Did I follow that right?
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Basically, yeah. If you were hiring, you know, not to say that these were the actual numbers, but just to make the math easy, if you wanted to hire 100 new engineers, boom, huge project, we need 100 software engineers,
yeah.
35 of them would be women. And then the other 65.
And then that would, you're on the right track. And then that would net us at 25% women by the end of the year.
Yeah, got it. So I'm going to address perhaps what might be a bit of an elephant in the room here. I am not 100% familiar. I will make this obvious that with the legal aspects of it, with the legalities of hiring. And also, you're in Canada, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So there may be, and probably a good venture to guess that there's different laws, there's different rules, there's different oversight regarding hiring and the laws and the rules in hiring in Canada versus the U.S. I mean, it can vary from state to state in the U.S. So we're all familiar with this kind of thing. It's kind of I'm not even sure exactly what question to ask, except that are there legalities? Are there legal concerns to be aware of when doing such an initiative?
So I think the really important thing to remember when we're talking about something like this is that we're not, the quota doesn't play into who we hire at the end of the day. We always hire the best person for the job. And we, what it really, what the quota changes is how we apply our focus in going out and finding really great people and convincing them to apply at Clio and enter our hiring process. It's very different between, you know, I think you would run into a lot of trouble if you were favoring a woman over a man. Mm-hmm. But Clio's also in the position where, hypothetically, if we had two identical candidates and one was female and one was male and they were both amazing, and we would just hire them both.
Sure. You know, you're growing, you're scaling.
There's really, there's really never a situation where we say, oh, we'll take her over him because she's a woman. Like, that's never going to be the scenario at Clio. And we're also not, like I mentioned, we're not talking about how we evaluate candidates.
Yeah.
We're talking about how we push ourselves to go and find someone who may not have entered our hiring process otherwise, because we believe that diverse teams are more high performing teams, mm-hmm. at the end of the day. And we want the highest performing team possible. So that means that we have to work harder at finding diverse candidates than we have previously.
Yep. And so that the result of pushing yourselves through that recruitment and sourcing process ends up in you hiring 35% women, because that's the way that ends up. They're the best candidates for the job. They're going to be the best, at least as far as you can tell, they're going to be the best performers. And that's where that 35% comes from. It's not from saying, right. And I think you made a really good point there, that you're hiring you're always making the decision about who's going to be the best person for this job. And because you've done such a great job of getting women applying for the jobs, and some really awesome women applying for the jobs, then it becomes, okay, who's the best person? And you end up with a more diverse, at least in terms of gender, diverse engineering org.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, another analogy that I like to use is that we're all very familiar with is thinking about a constraint on a software project. You know, let's say hypothetically you're delivering something in 2 weeks, that's your deadline, and you have four people on your team, and you have a certain quality bar that is non-negotiable, whether that's, you know, performance or bugs or whatever. And let's say something happens and you lose two people off that team. Now, you don't get to move your date and you don't get to compromise on quality. So what other levers can you pull? And that's where you're going to see a software team get really, really creative about what else we can kind of massage in order to meet the objectives that we can't move as mm-hmm. part of this project. And lo and behold, that team will deliver something that meets expectations, hasn't compromised quality, and by that date. Now, if you go back to the beginning, let's say you don't lose those two people, would the team have figured that out and delivered the project early? Mm-hmm. Probably not. So this is about just adding a constraint onto our process to just force us to figure out how to do something differently in order to get the result that we want, which is very high quality hires. You know, every hire, our rule is that they raise the bar for our team. And that's still true today, even though we've been hiring 35% women for the last few months. Like, that is not something that is negotiable for us. And you know, slowing the rate that we hire at is not something that's negotiable for us. So what other levers do we have available? And that's where, you know, the talent acquisition team and I have worked really closely over the last few months to come up with ways to, not even just us out in the community and connecting with people, but how do we take a, you know, nearly 100 person product department and engage all of them in going out in the community and connecting with people and helping to build our brand and having coffees and having phone calls and telling people about Clio and the opportunities that exist there.
And it's such a great analogy about adding constraints to the process to force yourself, to push yourself, to come up with those new levers, to use a term that's used a lot, to think outside of the box. But in this case, what you've been able to do is you've been able to not only create a high performing workforce and possibly even more high performing than you had before, but you're also creating a more diverse workforce as well. And a lot of people seem to think that those two are at odds with one another, that there's no way, well, if we want everybody, we can either go high performing or we can go diverse. You can't get them both. You know, you can't get your cake and eat it too. But more and more I'm hearing situations like this where it's absolutely possible. Is it easy? No, because it does involve that push and that sort of grind and let's make this work. But it's such a great example of how it's absolutely possible with the right team and the right focus. So there's so many reasons why I love this story. So thank you for sharing it. So we have a little bit of time left, Ames Ainsley, and I have one more question. And this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests. And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
I think it's how we get, how we help team members continue to grow and develop. So whether that's to move into, you know, more senior leadership positions or management positions. And as we increase the diversity of our team, this actually can get harder and harder. And simply because probably a lot of managers don't have a ton of experience managing a whole bunch of people who don't look like them. And it's through no fault of their own. You're now managing people who have very different life experiences, different challenges, whether it's personally and professionally. And we need to get really great at helping our managers manage diverse teams really well. But as an organization, how do we engage in now training a really diverse team, everyone included, to become strong leaders or strong managers in the organization? And this is a muscle that we are starting to build now. And I'm really excited to jump into this as a project over the next few months in collaboration with all of our dev managers, our VP of engineering, and our talent acceleration team.
Got it. Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because I know that while, you know, this new hiring initiative where you're, which really isn't just a hiring initiative, it's basically a diversity initiative where you've brought it from 13% to 21% is like, it clearly you're passionate about it. That's not all of your job. Your job is also in supporting the developers. And so when you say helping them to grow and develop, do you mean, like, for example, training initiatives, you know, things like that, like hackathons? Can you give us a sense of what that means, what that looks like?
Well, I'm figuring it out.
Okay.
We did relaunch hackathons in July of this year, and we're running them quarterly now. So we've had two so far. I think that's a big part of it for sure. But the next piece that we'll be rolling out is something a bit more formal, that, I mean, hopefully is also lightweight, especially in initially. So it's something we can put in place quickly, but developing a plan to better support folks in our organization and get them on a path towards whatever it is that they want to aim for. This is something that, of course, is the role of a manager. So I think there's some training for managers and how you engage in this with your direct reports. But also as an organization, like, what might a training program look like for folks who put up their hand and say, I am interested in becoming a manager, or I'm interested in becoming, you know, a leader, whether it's just through promotions as ICs, moving into, you know, staff and principal level development positions. We have both tracks at Clio, and both are really important for us to, I guess, have a more clear way for folks to engage when they're ready to start tackling that next step of their career. Mm-hmm.
And that's great to hear that you have those clear paths, because so many places that doesn't exist, where it's okay. Mm-hmm. I've been an IC, I've been an individual contributor, I've been a developer for X number of years. What's next? And there's no like sense of what that might be. We do have a little bit more time, and career paths is a topic that I think I'd love to keep talking about forever. But just to kind of give a little bit of the, you know, the Cliff Notes version of it. When you say that there's different career paths, one that's more like for the IC to principal and one that's more manager, can you just talk a little bit more about that so that folks can get a sense of, okay, what does this even look like?
Sure. So, I mean, let's start with individual contributors. Management isn't for everyone, and that's totally okay. I think Clio is as guilty as the next company in that it wasn't that long ago in our history where we looked at folks who were really technical and really great at what they did and driving things from from a leadership perspective, and were very vocal, that we looked at those people and said, you're going to manage teams. And most of those people are not managing teams anymore. And I think that's one of the things that I love the most about Clio, is that we learned that lesson, and we also eliminated any stigma around if managing people wasn't your thing, that's totally okay. Mm-hmm. So we have a track of folks who may or may not have tried managing people, but they've decided, at least for now, and they could change their mind at any point, that their focus is on being an individual contributor. And that still means that they can be a leader, and hopefully they are, in helping us make decisions, in mentoring other members of our team, but that they don't have anyone reporting to them. Mm-hmm. And then the other side is folks who want to manage people. And managing people is a very different job. And it's not, like I said, it's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really difficult job. And you think of just the amount of time that you need to spend with people in order to manage them well, and the emotional toll that can take, as well as you are empathizing and connecting with the people on your team and understanding where they're coming from and the things that they're struggling with, and what does their career path look like, and maybe dealing with performance issues, or the list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And we also at Clio expect our managers to still be writing code. So they're still technical members of our team, but they also may not be the most technical member of their team. You know, they may have someone reporting to them who is more technical, but their specialty, their secret sauce is going to be in, how do I get the most out of my team? And how do I support them? And how do I hire really great people? And how do I unblock the team so that they can do their best work? So they've got this whole other bucket of things to worry about that the individual contributors, the ICs on their team, don't have to worry about, because they know that their manager is taking care of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, it's so great to know that at Clio, you have those defined paths so that people can know those options. And I love that you mentioned about the stigma too, that it's like, if you don't want to manage people, there's no problem. You could still be a leader. You're going to be a leader in your own way. You're going to become, a principal engineer, or, you know, something like that, where you're going to be a leader in your own right. You're not going to manage the teams versus going the management route. I think it's so important for individuals to know that there's different paths available, and then of course for organizations to make that known to people and to support them, you know, whatever it is that people want to do, and how they want to use their skills and their, you know, the special secret sauce that makes them human and to make that shine within an organization. It sounds like that's really what's happening at Clio, so it's awesome to hear.
Yeah. And I don't think that you can know if you're going to like managing people or be good at it until you try. Like, it's a very, very different role. Yep. And I love that Clio has given the opportunity for people to try it and then to say, no, that wasn't for me. Or, you know, sometimes you see someone try and you're like, wow, that's going to be a a pretty rough adjustment for that person. And it, there's a little bit of stumbling at the beginning, and then they turn into amazing managers, and you would never have guessed. Like, yeah. I think it's really important for people to, if they have any inkling that it's something that they're interested in, that they can give it a shot. And also not just one shot. That I think we have someone in our organization who was an IC, tried management, went back to being an IC, who I think is thinking about management again. He's been at Clio for quite a while. And I'm like, that's so cool, because it also just depends on where you're at in life and where you're at in your career. I know people who have said that they tried managing people way too earlier in their career and they were awful at it. And then they turned into great managers later. And that can totally happen too. So having the space for people just to give it a try when it feels right for them. But also not to be alone when they do that, to be really supported in figuring out this completely new job that they're trying to take on for the first time.
Yeah, it is. That is so, so true. I absolutely 100% agree with you there. And so thank you so much, Ainsley, for taking the time to chat today. If people want
to... Totally my pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure is on my side as well. It's been awesome. And so if people want to reach out, whether it's online, on social media, what's the best way for people to contact you?
Great question. Email is probably easiest. It's my first name dot last name at clio.com.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Ainsley. Great, great conversation. And I wish you all the best, and wish you at Clio all the best as well. Keep doing all that awesome stuff.
Thanks, Jen.
Yeah, you're welcome.